All right. Okay, so we'll take a little bit of a step back. We started moving into Buddhism, but we still hadn't had a chance to talk yet about Jain Dharma. And actually, you know, one of the things that we should kind of take into consideration here, or we should try to practice here, is that referring to all of these religions, right, as an ism, these sacred traditions as isms, is an imposition of British colonial academia, right? It's not Buddhism. There's not like a word in Buddhism that they call, you know, that refers to them. They call it Buddha Dharma. And actually, what's interesting about this is, this would be the word for Buddha Dharma, Jain Dharma, and Hindu Dharma. And so actually, they wouldn't even use those words either, right? I'm not going to go into all that. But at any rate, so they wouldn't even use those adjectives. They would just call it Dharma. So you kind of have to ask, what Dharma do you follow? Something closer to the Hindu Dharma, or is it the Dharma of the Jains, or is it the Dharma of the Buddhas? So that word, as you know, means righteousness. It means custom. It means what we've come to call religion. And actually, one of the reasons why it gets equated with religion is that the sacred traditions that were encountered in the Eastern or Asian continent, in India and China, Mongolia, Tibet, all those places, they translated, especially in India, this word Dharma into religion, because these were the sacred traditions, and they were always trying to figure out, what do these sacred traditions have in contrast with Christianity? And this itself, it to me, is extremely interesting, because in all reality, Christians might call themselves Christians. I think that everyone's done that. But in one sense, everybody's kind of working under the assumptions of Western scientific taxonomy, right? People are not, originally Christians didn't call themselves Christians. They called themselves Christophers. Or in some areas, they called themselves Christophers. Why did they call themselves Christophers? Because the word meant a bearer of Christ. Saint Christopher's story is that he was crossing across a river, and he was a ferryman. And so fair, they had the P-H-E-R at the end of it, ferry. So he was a ferryman, and he was trying to get this little boy across the river. So the river, the boy climbs up on his back, and he starts carrying him across. And every step he takes, the child gets heavier and heavier and heavier, but he never stumbles and never falls, and he gets the child across. And when he gets the child across, he realizes that he was carrying Christ. So originally, the idea was that even people here, or you might say you're someone who follows, just like these are people who follow the Dharma of the Gita, the Dharma of Buddha, the Dharma of the Jain, what's the name of, his name just went out of my head, the Jain saint, the 24th, Mahavira, the Dharma Mahavira, or something like that. People say they follow the gospel or the good news or something along those lines. Jews say that they follow the Torah, right? Muslims or people of who are members of Islam say that they follow the Quran, right? So this need to refer everything to scientifically peg everything as an ism, I think that's something that we really need to kind of keep into consideration, because that making into an ism is actually whenever you see this word, it's the reduction of the world to one particular thing. And actually, while I think that kind of reduction works well in talking about to reduce everything to matter, that's materialism, or to reduce everything to ideas, that's idealism. Idealism is not the same thing as altruism, which is how people normally confuse the two. They say someone's being idealistic when actually they're being altruistic. So the reduction of the world to matter, the reduction of the world to ideas, the reduction of the world to life, that's biologism. Those kind of things, in one sense, they kind of make sense from a scientific point of view, but from the point of view of the worldviews and the sacred traditions that people follow, you know, I mean, it would be better to just say that these people, you know, this would work better as saying that they're Dharmists. But then Dharma changes depending on which sacred tradition you're talking about, right? Or to say that they're Gospelists. Something along those lines. Okay, so we're not really talking about, I mean, the word's going to get used, it's going to keep kind of coming up, but, you know, you stop me if I do it, or point it out, or take down how many times I slip back into it, because in one sense, it's a kind of colonialism. So we're not going to talk anymore, try not to talk anymore about Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism. We're going to talk about the Hindu Dharma, the Buddha Dharma, the Jain Dharma. Today, we're talking about the Jain Dharma. All right, let's move into that. Practice is that you have to look upon worldly things as the seer. You're not to be involved in them, because through attachment with worldly things, you land up with those problems that are existing in the world. If you detach yourself, you become only a seer, and then you attach yourself with the self only. So, Jain Dharma, as you can already see, is a little different from what Ben was talking about yesterday with Buddha Dharma, right? Jain Dharma believes that there is a self, that the self can detach from the material world, so you actually might be able to say that there is a dual kind of thinking between matter and soul, or matter and self. The idea that there can be this detachment . What does detached mean? Huh? To remove? To detach means to remove? Okay. What's detached mean? Oh, that, there you go. That's good. Actually, that's actually classical etymology. No touching. Right? So you have your visual senses, your aural senses. Yeah? Your oral senses. What do you call these senses? Huh? What? Yeah, the technical term's tactile. Tactile senses. So it means untouching. Good job. To not touch. To detach means that you no longer touch or hold something, right? So that then, for them, by these forms of ultimate detachment, or, right, their ultimate concern is to let go of all of these different kinds of ways that we attach to stuff so that we can only be attached to ourselves and the self can achieve liberation. If you detach yourself, you become only a seer, and then you attach yourself with the self only. So remember again also when Waleed and I was talking to Waleed and Edwina that time about the difference between hearing and seeing. And hearing has this quality of taking in and becoming a part of you. Seeing actually has the quality of distancing. Right, so here you actually see this represented. You actually, it shows distance, right? One other thing you see in this slide that's very important. Minnie Jane, their last name is Jane. So you almost always know someone's a Jane if their last name is Jane. It's very rare that you run across somebody with that last name and they're not actually a practicing Jane. We actually have a professor here at the University of North Texas who I work with, Pankaj Jane, who is a Jane, right? Okay.
Do they change their names?
No, that's just their name. Yeah. Now, how they can know what part of India you're from and like what sub-region based on what kind of first names you have. Right. So basics are that there's a wheel of time. That wheel of time keeps rolling over and over and over again, and it keeps repeating itself. You might have heard Nietzsche's famous notion of the eternal or infinite recurrence of the same. So in Jain cosmology, the world always has existed. There's no creation of the world. The world has always existed. And it moves through these cycles of time. And I'll have a presentation, a representation of that here in a little while. It moves through these cycles of time. During one particular cycle, because things begin to sort of move into the cycle of sadness or the cycle of, well, I think sadness is probably the best way to put it. Things move into the cycle of sadness. In order to move the world in the direction of happiness again, the Tirthankaras are born into the world. There have been 24 Tirthankaras. Mahavira is the last. He was a contemporary of Siddhartha Gautama, the person we call the Buddha, the awakened one. A Tirthankara is a ford maker. So actually, kind of like this, somebody who goes to the ford, to the crossing area, and helps you cross over, helps you make the way over, right? They steer people to... Let's do this right now. What am I doing? They steer people to the Dharma. So, as I said before, here's a picture, of course, of the 24 Tirthankaras. The one in the middle is Mahavira, the last. So, the Tirthankaras originally formed two ascetic orders. That word ascetic is extremely important. It gets used and abused inside of philosophy and religion. It derives from the Greek word ascesis. Derives from the Greek word ascesis. Ascesis means practice or discipline. rigorous practice or discipline? I mean, if you could make an argument that you actually could translate dharma into asceticism, considering that dharma in one sense is a rigorous practice, right? Religion is literally ascetic or has an asceticism if you actually think of religion in the old meaning of the word, which is someone who strictly practices, right? But this word asceticism is very important and something for y'all to think about, because it has a tendency, once you begin to talking about asceticism, there's that ism again, that reduction of everything down to a particular kind of practice. It's usually a radical form of practice. So yesterday when Ben was here talking to y'all about Siddhartha and the Heart Sutra, right, he pointed out that one of the things Siddhartha had done was overcome asceticism, right? Because he lived with these people who had begun a practice. They would like stand on one foot for years, right? Or I've seen pictures of them where, and I'm assuming that this is not just an exaggeration, right? Because you see, even if all you do is look at Western Christianity, you see among certain Protestants and definitely among certain mystical Catholics a desire to be ascetic to the point of the body being abused, right? And so there were some ascetics who would go off into the forest practicing the Hindu Dharma, or what would come to be called the Hindu Dharma. These monks who'd go off into the forest and they would live there, and they'd do something like pick up a clod of dirt, and they'd hold it in their hands for years. It had seeds in it. So the seeds began to sprout, and they're growing in their hands. Right? Do what? No, they don't really, no. No, just hold it. Hold life. Right? So asceticism can go, when we're talking about asceticism, the idea here, of course, is to reduce everything down to the need to perform a kind of practice or discipline that is radical or extreme. Radical or extreme practice. I'm not going to show you the pictures of Jane Digambaras who have, or even I think a few Svetambaras who've taken a vow of the ultimate vow of a Jain, which is to never eat another thing. So they starve themselves to death. Right, in order to reduce the suffering in the world, they refuse to eat. Okay, so there are pictures you can find. I'm not going to show you the pictures. This practice has actually been outlawed in India. It's one of the ways that India, I think that it would be outlawed in the United States too, probably, because it's, you know, we would look at it as a form of suicide. Right? They look at it as a form of ultimate release. But at the top here, you actually see examples of Digambaras. Digambaras are the sky-clad. They don't wear any clothes. They carry a little fan around so that they can sweep the ground in front of them to make sure that they don't step on any insects, so that they can bat away flies. There are some Digambaras who will walk around. This is I don't mean to say, because I don't want to like get into, you know, a version of, you know, like he was talking yesterday about Zen porn. I don't want to get into a person, you know, of, you know, talking about radical examples, but just so you can kind of get an idea of commitments and things like that. There's some Digambaras who wander around with a bed mat. And they go to the houses of householder Jane, right? Because the distinction is between the people who take up one of these ascetic callings and the people who just live a householder life. They have a different kind of series of codes. It's not as strict. They go to the houses, they go to a householder's abode, and they stand outside, and the person comes out and agrees to donate a certain amount of money to help with the upkeep of a Jain temple or something like that. And the person lays down for the karma of that person doing that. The person lays down on the bed mat and proceeds to be eaten by bed bugs. So the bugs feed. So the bugs have food, right? So that's one. Again, I don't want to get into this too deeply because the more you get into it, it's so outside the realm of our normal experience. It begins to look more like, you know, kind of you're just being sensational. But there's a lot of, this is actually one of the reasons I would say that next to Judaism, Jainism is one of the smallest religions in the world, of the great religions. Huh?
You just used the isms.
Yeah, I did. Damn it. Jain Dharma has one of the fewest followings in the world. It's comparable to Jewish Torah followers, Sikh, and a few people who follow the path of Ahura Mazda or Zoroaster. Those sacred traditions are actually very small, but we still call them great traditions because they've had an effect on other traditions and effect on a great many, many people, right? Let Jains only make up about top 7 or 8 million people in the world, six, seven million people, something like that. Well, I mean, you can imagine if the strict observance of the Jain tradition leads to these kinds of asceticisms and even the householder's version can be fairly strict when it comes to being a religion and the fact that it's not actually what you would call, excuse me, a sacred tradition that has conversion as an aspect of what it is. Like the Buddha Dharma or the Christian path or the Muslim path. It's not very appealing to a lot of people, right? On the other hand, based on your questions and based on some of the things that y'all wrote in your shared writings, you know, quite a few of you really resonate to some of the ideas of the Jain Dharma, right? So, the ethical pillars for freeing the soul, jiva samsarajina. The jiva is the individual's higher consciousness or soul. So even there, again, whenever you're talking about self or soul in these Indo-European languages, it's just so the basic Sanskrit word for soul, as we know, is atman. But even jiva, it's still that breathing, it's still that life breath concept. So the self or the jiva, the higher consciousness, the consciousness that can be released of karmic debt. Samsara, the wheel of birth and death. Samsara is also used as a terminology. This is another one of those terminologies like bhakti and dharma and karma that gets used across all religions that are born in, excuse me, all sacred traditions that are born in India. Jina, winner, one who's conquered his passions. I don't see Charlie Sheen becoming a Jain, but winner, yeah, Jina, winner. So here's that wheel of time. Now notice it's all broken up into different ages, right? And actually, one thing that the Jain, I think, contribute to world history, to world thinking, is the notion that the world can be really long, right? So unlike inside of the Abrahamic faiths, where philosophizing can get you to the point of saying that a day is like 1,000 years to God, or well, if the wisdom literature says that a day is like 1,000 years to God, or 1,000 years is like a day to God, then you can extrapolate philosophically that, you know, God could have made the world over the course of billions of years in the creation story, right? Because time doesn't move the way it does for God. But in Jainism, this is not an issue. In Jainism, so stop me out of it. In Jain Dharma, this isn't an issue. In the Jain Dharma, they already have huge amounts of times that they talk about. Hundreds of millions and billions of years. Right? The idea, of course, there is that they so take to heart the notion that the world has always been, and that it's been on a sort of like a sort of eternal or infinite recurrence of the same, that, you know, why would you get messed up in the notion that the world is just 6,000 years old or 100,000 years old? So I think one of the things that they contribute to world thinking was that they were the first people to recognize that the world or the universe, the cosmos, could be billions of years old, right? Now, as an aside, and this is only an aside, and it has no academic backing whatsoever, but I noticed a long time ago, and I found it kind of interesting, that it was the adoption of mathematical thinking that was originally created by Indian thinkers that came into the West to Western science by way of Islam that led us to a science that could postulate the world being really old, right? And I've always kind of wondered if the ability to do that kind of mathematics that comes with it, in other words, that mathematics actually developed as a way of having another language of expressing these large amounts of time and cyclic cycles. And so as that makes its way through, you know, you kind of ask yourself, well, math is very pure, but are there sociocultural remainders that stay inside that thinking, or is it just that thinking that opens you up to that possibility, right? That the world might actually be really old, or that the universe might actually be really old. Like I said, that has no academic backing to it. It's just something I used to think about when I was 18 or 19 years old. Okay, so karma. Now, here's one place where, you know, you really see these words, these concepts, they go in a little bit of a different direction than the ones that you've been used to with the Hindu Dharma and the Buddha Dharma. In the Hindu Dharma and the Buddha Dharma, karma is very much a description of cause-effect, right? Here, karma is actually material effect. It's actually matter, right? You actually, the more karma that you build up, the more you actually are gaining matter. Subtle matter, but still matter, right? And that matter dislocates the self, the jiva, and it causes you, in one sense, to veer off course. You know how something that's weighed too, you know, a car that's overweighted will swerve very easily, or it'll rock a lot more, or it could even turn over. So it's the idea of you get this extra weight, right? So the thing that you're actually, and it's things, the things that you're actually trying to detach from is you might call it the karma seeds or the karma matter or something like that. So karma is a material concept for the Jain Dharma. Do you have any questions? Yeah, David. Well, it weighs your soul. It's like it literally weighs your soul down. In other words, the idea is kind of slightly close to a kind of Platonic notion of the soul, which is the heavier you get, the more you fall down to the earth. You get attached to the things that don't actually have any. They don't have real substance. So the soul actually should be light. So how do you measure it? I mean, I suppose it becomes in that regard, it's like, you know, how poor the life of the person is, how off track the person is, the fact the person wasn't born to Jain Dharma. Yeah, so... I think actually among some Jain scholars, they actually do come up with mathematical formulas for figuring out. Yes, Alex.
So for them, there's no good karma. Good karma or bad karma is just.
No, good karma. I mean, and even there to say that it's bad, you know, good and bad karma. It's just simply karma is heaviness, and so you just want to lose it. It just keeps you heavy. So, you know, in one sense, karma, then you might say, always lead, because it leads to that heaviness, it's always bad or off-putting. So you need to let go in order to decrease the karma. Oh, I'm sorry, Mina. What do you want now? Say that one more time. They're what?
That all of them tend to deny, like defy, or you know, think that human is something bad or something. You know, they, like, nature. We have a human nature that we say. They tend to defy that, and all of these concepts that we have are pretty much based on the culture that is around them.
Well, I think that you'll find that's the case with everybody who talks about being human. I mean, what do you mean when you say denying or defying human nature? I don't think that I understand that. Oh, that's a genuine question. What do you mean when you say that? Like
they're saying that human, being a human, is the best state you can be in.
The best stage.
Yes.
Yes.
They say that because you were born as an animal, and
right, right.
And finally you were a human.
Right.
And then you should use this state to maybe attain
detachment. Right. Moksha. Right. Liberation.
And they are humans. So, what's wrong with people? That's a human being. There's nothing wrong
sure.
with it.
But like, there's nothing wrong with eating, but there is wrong, but there are ways you can, there's nothing wrong with eating per se, to use, you know, Western philosophical language. There's nothing wrong with eating per se, but there can be things wrong with eating if you do it in a way that causes more harm than good to yourself or to something
that
else.
I understand, but
right.
Not eating or, what about human dignity? Why do they have to beg for their food?
Now you're getting into a cultural distinction. In some cultures, begging denies human dignity. Not dignity. It denies human dignity. In some cultures, begging is actually the pinnacle of human dignity.
But I understand those cultures very well. I've been raised in those cultures.
Yeah.
Begging is considered very bad.
Well, not if you're a monk.
Well, yes, it is. Because, you know, the books are saying something, but I have seen these people in reality.
Oh, well, you know, whenever you're talking about what the sacred scriptures might teach, or you're talking about what the sacred traditions might hold, that doesn't mean that the people who are, you know, supposedly Christian people who follow the gospel of Jesus Christ are supposed to be charitable. I don't find a great deal of charity among most of the people I know that are Christian. I mean, yeah, they'll give some money, but charity actually means the ability to help and to give without any expectation of return and without any question, right? So there's always a distinction to be made between the ideas. Now, you move out, you brought in a very good thing, you know, because you want to look at the experience. I said originally we want to do as much phenomenology from experience as we can. You have experience of being from Pakistan, of Indian culture, and you know, people who practice Hindu Dharma or Jain Dharma or Buddha Dharma in Pakistan or in areas of India you might have visited. So you've seen these things. Give us a report about some of the things you've seen among people who claim to follow these dharmas.
Yes, so
like what you were just saying. So start there. Unpack it a little more.
Yeah, so you know what? But the book is saying things that, you know, because I have seen this many times as, you know, going to the universities in the West. Mm-hmm. All of these things, West have its own perspective.
Sure.
And they define things and write these books from their perspective.
Right.
And it might not be their perspective of those cultures.
Right. Well, I think though that, but I think that what you're talking about is that, I mean, I've met scholars from all, scholars and monks and holy people from all of these traditions, and they claim that this is the teachings of these traditions, but they also tell me that just like in the West, very few people actually follow the teachings of the tradition.
Yeah, of course.
So, you know, now you come up on what makes, in one sense, one way that you know, can know that you're probably dealing with a real sacred tradition from a culture, is that you will discover very quickly hypocrisy.
Right. It's everywhere in every religion, but right. What I'm saying is, like, why do they not accept human nature?
Well, see, that's the part where you're kind of I want to tangle with you in a loving struggle about, right? I don't know what human nature is. What is human nature?
Like, you know, being human, but
well, sure, it's being human. Logic. I get that. But
who gets to label that is what I'm saying. Like there is, if you want to resort saying what is human nature, and if depending on whatever you follow or what you believe in, there's other human nature. So my human nature is to say I'm pain, and my purpose is to crawl on the ground and carry, you know, 30 pounds of rocks on my back, and then I'm gonna die, and then the next day I'm gonna come and take my place. Or the human nature could be like I am supposed to eat and shower and sleep and do things that we're doing right now, or even see that. Somebody's still making a label.
Sure, but your point here is that your experience has been I guess maybe what I'm trying to understand is you say why do they deny human nature? Is that what you've been saying, right? Why do they? What is the what is it that they're denying about human nature? That.
Like, if I put it on myself, there are some things as a human that I know are there.
Okay.
Standards of good and bad, and all humans agree on it, right? That's we call it ethics now, right? We call it ethics, but all religions say that what are ethics? They're just the consequences that we see of our actions.
Okay, but I'm still trying to understand what you're saying it is that they're doing that denies human nature. What are they doing that denies human nature? When they go begging, why does that deny human nature?
Like, what human nature is that we like to know things, we like to satisfy our logic. And I'm not understanding why are certain sacred traditions that are against the reason and logic that human beings have. Why can't they go together?
Well, but see, I think what's interesting in what you're saying is you're saying that all of this is arrived at without reason and logic, and I would say it's all arrived at by reason and logic. If you actually follow through what they're saying, right? I mean, I've said the whole time, one of the things I've been trying to get across in this notion of the myth or the narrative of orderly exchange is that the very thing that makes it orderly exchange is that it's reasonable. Now, it may be that you deny a premise, right? Karma is material. You might deny that premise, right? But the real point that you want to make here is, that you want to follow through on here is that if they set out their beliefs in an orderly way, right, what you'll find among all these sacred traditions is that at the heart of it, They're not logically inconsistent.
Like I also put the question in there that they consider that human beings are the height of goodness.
Right.
If you're very good, you'll become a human being.
You'll
be born as a human being.
Sure.
And then we see that the world population is increasing. So is the goodness increasing?
Well, I know you wrote that as one of your things.
Right. But on the other hand, there's Kali Yoga, and you know, like this is what I might think. Like I told you, I have a very scientific background to everything.
Sure.
For me, so I think from that perspective.
Right, right. Well, but if you look at it from that perspective, I mean, the basic idea here holds across these religions, it holds across these sacred traditions. Why does being born a human being mean that you've... See, I don't necessarily know that it means that you've been good or that you know, good or bad is these concepts, I think, get in the way a lot of times. As you work through your karma, right? Once you reach the level of being a human being, you're in what most of these traditions call, I would to put it in the vernacular, would call a sweet spot. If you were to be born a god, you're stuck for the duration of a cycle. If you're born any of these other things, you know, you kind of move along through the cycle, but your life generally is going to be fairly short, with the exception of some mammals, and then finally you're born. But what's the difference that they hold? It actually is the elevation of human nature as a sweet spot because, and this I think is something that you would find inherent in all these dharmas, but this is actually a Hindu dharma saying. To be born a human being, okay, to be born a human being is a wonderful event because it gives you the opportunity to achieve liberation through your own decisive effort, right? So the issue of being born a god is that, yeah, you've got a lot of power, but you're sort of stuck till the next incarnation. To be born any of these animals, you don't actually have rational decision, or you don't have a very broad rational decision. So you get to the point of being born a human being, and you have that ability to achieve liberation through your own decisive effort, right? And one of the things that all of these dharmas hold in common is this notion of working through your own decisive effort. Sure.
So, but my question is, how do you know that this bird was not there like 10 days ago?
Well, I mean, now one of the problems that, of course, you always get into when you study these things is that you get into the issue of being able to talk about something in the general, which might begin to reveal some better understanding when you have a particular experience, and then having a particular experience and then realizing that, you know, people in their daily lives don't seem to actually think through the things that they're saying. So one of the reasons why you almost always turn to the scholars and the priestly class to think about these things is that they're the ones who actually attempt, though they may end up in some ways being hypocrites, they're the ones who tried to put forward an expression of what the basic tenets are. You know, everybody. Right. I understand. How do they know that's their a feeling? I mean, you know, how do they know that that bird wasn't there 10 days ago? I don't know. Does the fact that it was, I mean, these kind of things, when people are grieving, they tend to not pay attention anymore to their belief systems, right? Once they, you know, because it's a very tenuous relationship. But I think these are really good points and really good questions, because in a lot of ways it shows that for some reason human beings do have a high regard for being human, mostly. Most human cultures have a high regard for being human, and we see it as something special. And two things happen from that. One is to highlight the kinds of practices that you can engage in that will make you a better human. And the other is to account for and describe all of the myriad ways that people that people really, in a sense, waste being human. Right? So this is a good place to stop for right now. Let's go ahead and take a break, and then we'll come back. I like these questions. I don't want you to think that I'm... Okay, all right.